Welcome to today's 6th CEU seminar called Everyone Matters, Integrating Cultural Competency in Mental Health Care. I'll be your provider for today's seminar. My name is Michelle Sparks, and I'm the owner and director of River of Life Professional Counseling. This 6th CEU seminar is pre-approved by the State of Ohio Counselor, Social Worker, and Marriage and Family Therapist Board for licensed professional counselors, licensed professional clinical counselors, and supervising counselors in Ohio, as well as licensed social workers, licensed independent social workers, and supervisory social workers in the state of Ohio. This issue of what is culture and how do we define it? How do we constitute integrating culture into the work we do is a very, very important, timely one. I always say when we're doing treatment planning with our clients and the psychosocial assessment and setting that we're in, that it's really important to individualize treatment to each and every client. And as we find out today, culture is a very important foundation of what we mean when we're talking about individualizing treatment planning to each client. Culture is such a broad term. Traditionally, years ago, in the last several decades, when the research was first being done regarding being culturally appropriate in the mental health field, they talked a lot about race and ethnicity. But one thing we'll find out in today's seminar is that culture really is the way any group of people commonly identify or associate with one another. It could be anything from the music they listen to. It could be their way of identifying based on a physical attribute, a common purpose, a need, or a similarity of background. It could be based on the living arrangements or their beliefs of any kind of sort of value. It could be based on their hobbies. So traditionally, we've heard things about sex, religion, sexual orientation, lifestyle management, which are included under this big umbrella of culture. But today I'd like us to think even in a more broad sense about what culture is, because any of those values, beliefs, and ways of approaching life will color the way that our clients approach the world. I use more recently a lot of acceptance and commitment type of therapy, positive psychology, and strengths-based work, which I find is very important because it will play on what the client's individual values are. So essentially, when we're looking at what culture is defined as, we're looking about a group of people who have agreement about the way anything is done. So according to this, someone could be looking at culture on a number of different areas simultaneously. So when we're talking about meeting our clients and being culturally competent in the mental health field, we're talking about really a balancing act of integrating culture on several levels for each individual client. So it's not just one or two isolated factors. We're looking at a number of co-occurring dynamics and then looking at which of these this particular client considers important to the presenting concerns that he or she are bringing in to the counseling context. We want to make sure, too, that we're not assuming something is culturally relevant or culturally irrelevant for that person. And we'll talk more about that as we go on. So multicultural competence then becomes the extent to which counselors possess appropriate levels of self-awareness, knowledge, and skills in working with individuals from diverse cultural backgrounds. Mayfield, in a 2020 article, so pretty recent here, talked about defining more specifically what cultural competence entails. He included more definitions, like the ability to use critical thinking skills to interpret how cultural values and beliefs influence conscious and unconscious behavior. That's interesting. So, for example, I could be meeting with a certain client and noticing themes coming up in various sessions. And I might think, oh, I remember when we first met for that diagnostic assessment session, that person talked about the values of multiple generations in their home. Then a few sessions ago, again, the person said, oh, my grandparents, my aunts and uncles, my parents, this one, that one, all believe such and such. So in that case, for example, I might check in with the client and say, oh, I'm hearing again some examples about the role of the opinions of the different generations of your family of origin, not just your parents, but extended family in terms of determining certain things about your life. Is that an important foundation that you would like for us to talk about in our counseling sessions? So again, I don't assume just because I'm hearing a theme, ah, that's what it's got to be about, all those opinions of all the relatives. Instead, we come at it with the client from the point of view, would you like to integrate this? Is this possibly important? Or am I just hearing something of the background, but this is not a key in what you want to focus on in your counseling? So, secondly, Mayfield in his article talks about culturally being competent in terms of understanding how inequity can be and has been perpetrated through socialized behaviors. So over time, there's some things where there hasn't been fairness. We'll talk later about the concept of social justice, which you probably especially heard a lot about in the news and in the literature lately because of groups of people like the Black Lives Matter group or different other groups about different belief systems and making sure people had access to services, access to similar ways of being interpreted in different circumstances. So equality and fairness are big concepts for people. And then when we talk about what a client might consider as discrimination, that's another one. So fairness is a general value that many of our clients come in to their sessions talking about in one form or another. For example, if a client's coming in who's going through grief, he or she might bring up, well, why did that person die young? Or why did that person have to pass? They may be going through a struggle with what we call meaning making or trying to make sense of things. And they might think, well, gosh, that person was, quote, a good person. They did great things. They were moral, ethical. They were wonderful. Or maybe they were only a child. They didn't, quote, deserve to have their life taken from them. And so inequities, inequalities, things that don't feel fair are oftentimes themes of what our clients bring to us. Also take, for example, the traumatized or abused client. That person may feel very targeted, and rightfully so, that a perpetrator of some sort took advantage of them in a weak point of view. And now they're wondering, who can they trust anymore? Let's look at a third definition that Mayfield in his article talks about in terms of defining cultural competence. He also talks about making sure that we as professionals have the knowledge and the disposition to disrupt inequitable practices to achieve greater personal, and professional success for ourselves and others. So he basically says we have a responsibility when we see inequality, when we see people not having access to similar mental health services who need it. So for example, I remember at a private hospital I used to work at, we would have such an array of clients come as walk-ins for assessments, whether they're homeless people, whether they're professional career people, whether they're educated or uneducated, whether they had their own car to drive them there, or whether they were dropped off by law enforcement or by a friend or relative who thought they needed help. There's such a variety. Some clients having insurance or excellent insurance, others having no insurance at all, or maybe Medicare or Medicaid insurance. Do they all have the same access to the services that we provide? Or, based on the type of setting, for example, that we might work in, what is our responsibility? So, for example, you know that I work in a suburban private practice setting. So, I am a for-profit organization. Being for-profit, there are certain things I have to do to make my bills and rent and to provide for the business. So there's a way I need to think of how do I balance out the needs of being a for-profit agency and also making sure I am fair and accessible to people who may need services. One way of doing that is offering self-pay options for people who may not have insurance. Also, making them aware of benefits and services that they do have access to. For example, I'm on a number of EAP panels, meaning panels for those that get free sessions through their employers. They may get 6 or 8 sessions, for example, through a given employer, and they may or may not realize that. That can save someone a lot of money to not have to pay out of pocket. Or even someone who comes to me on their EAP sessions may not even realize that with certain insurances that they may get a new round of EAPs or a new authorization for EAPs based on different issues that they may be undergoing in their life. That can save them money. Now, what if a person just does not have any insurance or anything I take? I might have to negotiate ways to work with other benevolence ministries in the church, in a community, or other outreach to possibly provide for their services. Or I may have to link them to other places that I know do great work to provide wonderful, excellent clinical practices for people who do not have access to services, or may help even in linking them up with the type of services they need and maybe even obtaining things like Medicaid and other benefits that may help them. And finally, when Mayfield is talking in his article, he mentions that cultural competence is a design for living. I think that's an interesting phrase. A design for living passed from generation to generation as a pattern of interpreting reality. Wow, that's a real different way than maybe we ever conceptualized it before. So basically, culture is a filter for how we interpret, for example, things like sickness and health. Think of the different clients you may have had over time. There are some clients that do believe in the medical model, but there are a number of our clients who don't. Maybe they think sickness and health have more to do with your own self-will. If you make bad choices, then anxiety and depression happen to you and other mental health illnesses. Or they might think spiritually, if you're not doing right in God's eyes, something happens. Or maybe they have a belief from where they're from that if you do certain things, you get certain results in life, and this is a punishment or a reward for those behaviors. Again, I may not personally think those things, but it is important for us when we're doing our psychosocial assessment from day one, from the beginning of our interaction with the client, to look at what is this pattern, this way that each client interprets his or her reality. Essentially, this boils down to which aspects of who this client is as a person prevail. So we have multiple cultures, so to speak, that are simultaneously at work in a person. One of the things we don't want to gloss over today is the idea that we don't want to forget about intergroup differences. Oftentimes, the way the media might portray cultural issues to us, or the way even our own mental health literature and articles may talk about, they tend to stereotype or make generalities regarding different types of groups. So they might say people with this ethnicity tend to have A, B, and C. People who live in this part of the United States tend to undergo these issues. People of this age group tend to do such and such. Remember, as I said earlier, the way we need to approach these issues to make sure that we're giving that vibe to the client that every single one of them matters and the different cultures which are simultaneously at work matter is to ask, what is most important to this given client? Ask, is this a central factor or not? So I wanted to bring up a number of possible clinical case issues. And as I kind of read from these, think to yourself, would you consider these cultural things that need to be thought about? Again, which aspects of culture prevail? Is it a cultural issue to say that you have a client who's an elderly woman who was raised in an Asian culture who is now ailing with health issues and uncertain what the future will hold? Think about that for a minute. Remember, for a given person, we can't make an assumption. We really need to ask and find out from the client which aspects are important to him or her. So it may be that our client, who was raised in Asian culture, has some points of view about youth and about maturity or older age, about what constitutes respect, about who's supposed to take care of you when you're older and how that looks. I don't want to assume that for that person, just because the other Asian people I've dealt with, that's a central issue. So I'll ask them. I might say, oh, so it sounds like you were born in such and such country or area. Tell me a little bit about what some of the beliefs are about expectations for how people are approached who are elderly and what your expectations are about what you hoped life would look like at this point versus how it is looking as you're coming into me. Now, this also says that this elderly woman who was raised in an Asian culture is ailing and having health issues. That's another piece. Just defining what constitutes health, what constitutes disease, whether it's physical disease or whether it's emotional or mental health issues, may be different for different clients. That's something that I would ask her too about when she's talking about health issues. Help me understand what is considered issues to her. So keep in mind, you know, I don't know if you've ever looked in our DSM at the culture-bound syndromes. So we tend to know the common disorders we deal with our clients, like major depression or dysthymia, things like generalized anxiety or panic disorder, things like bipolar or different types of mood disorders, as well as other adjustment disorders, personality disorders, etc. But what about culture-bound syndromes? For example, do those even apply in this case? again, we want to go back to asking the client. There are some people that I've run into, both in a clinical counseling office, as well as when I've done overseas ministry work, that have beliefs, again, about sickness and health, about the origin of well-being, or the origin of problems that might involve spirits, that might involve spiritual dimensions, or nature, or people's personality, what is good or bad, or affirmed or punished. And so we want to hear the narrative of the client, so we don't assume wrongly anything about this. And again, this particular client, in her case, it says she's uncertain about what the future will hold. That may be tough for her. I mean, anyone, you know, automatically we're probably thinking, in my mind, I'd be thinking, oh, wow, generalized anxiety, worries about what next, how things are going to pan out, how will I be taken care of, how will I approach things. But again, when you layer on top the other potential issues about the other aspects of culture, of how older people, quote, should be taken care of, what, if anything, is the role of her Asian culture? What are the expectations or assumptions about age? There's a lot of different layers there. So we're having each client to construct his or her narrative individually and meeting them where they're at. Let's look at a second example here. Which aspects might prevail for this person? A middle-aged single parent who's raising 5 children on her own, juggling tasks on a daily basis. I know for me, having been a single parent, it's easy to have all kinds of assumptions about what another single parent might be going through. The stresses, the juggling, the how many jobs they might be working, how successfully they feel they are approaching, or how they feel they're not approaching day-to-day tasks well. From my own experience, I might think about things like their finances, things like how many or how few support systems they have. But again, that's my worldview. That's what I've gone through. So I might need to talk with this person and find out, is the fact of this person being a middle-aged single parent important to him or her? The 5 children, are there assumptions I'm making about if it was 1 child versus 5 children, what does that look like? It's important for me to hear that narrative. And what juggling tasks, what assumptions this parent has. So we really want to hear, what are you coming in for? Why is this presenting concern important to you now? And what is it that you feel like you need at this time? How would you know that therapy successful, that I'm really making a difference, that we're really getting the job done, so to speak? Those are the same questions regardless of which aspects of culture we're looking at. Let's look at a third example in terms of this concept of which aspects prevail. What about a teenager in a poverty-stricken neighborhood who is frequently tired because of working extra hours to help the family and provide for the younger siblings? Again, as I read this, you might have a picture in your head of what this teenager looks like, that they're juggling being parentified. Basically, they're having to work before their time. You might have an idea about how do they juggle school, juggle their own teenage sorting through who I am, identity, what place I have in the world, but then also, how do I be an example for younger siblings? You might have your own assumptions about if this is a good or a bad thing, but it's important, if we're going to be multiculturally competent, to find out what the narrative is surrounding that particular teenager's life. What happened? Did a parent or guardian or significant person in their life die? Was there a change where someone wasn't able to be there for the other kids, that this person is having to provide for the younger siblings? And even the definitions, the operational definitions we use, we want to hear what the client's culture is about those. What does provide mean? If this teenager is saying that it's his or her job to provide for the younger siblings, what does that entail? Is that just being a good example when they're around, or making sure they have a snack after school and do their homework? Or is it holding down a job to add some extra money to what a parent can provide? It could mean many things. Is the fact of being in a, quote, poverty-stricken neighborhood, unquote, important? And what does that look like? What resources, for example, does this family have access to? Are they aware of those resources? Is it our role? And in what way is it our role to help link them to those resources? Let's look at another example here. A young adult is fearful of moving out of the country or the county they live in, away from her people, and venturing beyond to find a, quote, better life. So anytime someone's doing something new and different from what they did before, there can be anxiety, there can be stress. But I'd be interested in the narrative of what people have said to this young adult about venturing away from the known, venturing away from the expectations of the county, and even this judgment about finding a, quote, better life. Better according to whom? Is this better life what this client that we're talking to is seeking? Even if it's better for him or her, does the client feel like he or she has the support of the people that are around them? Just because it feels better doesn't mean there's support. And then that becomes a central cultural issue in the counseling that we're doing. We're not here to judge the actions of a client. So, for example, this reminds me of when I worked in Southern Ohio, and it was frequently the norm among the people in the counties that I worked in that they encouraged their relatives to stay in those counties, to stay among, quote, their people, to pull together, to be resourceful, even if the resources were limited. And there was this mentality among many people in the counties that I served at the time that you don't move beyond the country. You don't go up to the bigger city, to Columbus. That's different. And so I remember when I worked with children in elementary, junior high, and high schools, and especially the high schoolers wanting to go up to the city, up to Columbus, to go and get college training or career or work somewhere where they might get paid more money than in their county. And for many of these young people, they really had to make some decisions, because whatever decisions they made would impact possibly what the relatives might think of them. And for some people, they chose to forego better money, forego possible career training, forego college, because they didn't want to rock the boat. Other people, they chose to go for this quote-unquote better life, knowing they may not get the support of some of their people from the county. Again, which aspects prevail for the client? And let's look at this last example. An adult has tensions with his parents about the way things have always been done and what choices he should make now. So again, there's a lot of assumptions and opinions about, as I said, for the definition of culture, the way things should be done. We need to hear what the client's coming to us with regarding his or her assumptions of the way things should be done. So this starts from the very second of assessment. I've cited a 2010 article by Braun, Fine, Grief, and Devenny about the multicultural assessment areas and what we really need to target. So one of the things we always want to be doing is increasing our self-awareness. We want to make sure that when we're working with clients that we're looking at the definitions of culture and being culturally sensitive ourselves. But we also want to increase the client's own self-awareness. What are the definitions, the themes, the beliefs, the patterns that seem to be coming out in that person's sessions? We want to be able, as we hear the narrative, to account for clients' multiple identifications. Like I said, culture, we have several simultaneous continuums of cultural things and definitions going on at once within a given person. We may want to start forming a working hypothesis based on what the client tells us when we do that assessment. We want to understand what that person's baseline is. And we also want to look at the sociocultural and sociopolitical context in which their behaviors are occurring. Then we want to find unique qualities. Again, how is the client defining things? What are they saying is their narrative surrounding things? Are there any physical factors that play into things? What psychological conditions or stressors are going on? And have any of the identities of what they would say contribute to their specific culture shifted over time? See, it's interesting. So we're trying to hear a client's cultural narrative, but the narratives are in flux. They're constantly shifting. And they will probably shift through our work with them. So they're not stagnant things like, oh, this person came in and their culture is that they believe A, B, and C. Possibly over time in the discussions and the narratives and the themes and the treatment that we're doing with them, there may be some changes to certain portions of their cultural identity. There may be certain aspects that they're pretty firmly grounded in about who they believe they are. For example, as a male or female, living in this area versus that area, the type of career or work they do or don't do. Those may be fairly stable. They may not be stable. Any of those might be things they want to change. So we have to look at what are the areas that they would say are the cores of who they are, and what are some of the things that are sort of in process. So when we're looking at problems and issues or presenting concerns, as we define it in the mental health setting, from a multicultural point of view, there's some questions that are key. First of all, what is the problem? Again, according to the client. What is the mission or agenda at this time? So what is the main thing we're focusing on? What goals are we looking at? So we're talking about concrete behavioral goals. We're talking about efficacious treatments. And when we talk about treatments, I want to highlight not just what the clinical literature says is efficacious, but do I really know, given the types of areas that are simultaneously at work and what this client's saying is culturally important to him or her, what is efficacious with those dynamics? So, for example, there may be certain religious groups that I just don't know all what they believe in. So I might want to have a release of consent signed by my client for me to be able to consult with their religious leader. I might have people that live in a certain community where that community's views really are central. I might want to consult with someone who they consider central to their definition of family or community. So what is the problem? What is the mission or agenda at this time? What are the goals? Next, what can we learn about this? How do we redirect this issue or conflict from the client's point? So when we do things with multiculturally competency, there are some positive benefits. There's increased productivity. When we're working even from a point of view of multicultural competency within an organization, say a mental health agency, say a hospital, say a community agency, even a private practice setting, we find actually in the literature that there's increased productivity because each member of the team of the mental health group is able to contribute about their understanding of culture as well as learn from others. There is a sense of better problem solving and creativity. And when we're looking for interviewing and hiring, we're better able to attract different kinds of talent and to retain that talent because the structure of what we do as clinicians and how we do that may be a little bit different. There may be flexibility, which is really neat when we have multicultural competency. There tends to be improved interpersonal and communication skills because we're learning how to negotiate problems, issues, worldviews with different approaches simultaneously, even amongst ourselves and the mental health agencies. We're developing mutual understanding and respect among employees. We're looking at the appropriateness for new perspectives, new strategies and ideas. And this can cultivate a feeling of belonging by all those in a certain department or an agency and increase cooperation and trust. So some of the skills that are being built up are relational skills, tolerance of uncertainty, adaptability, learning to be flexible and around different people, around different issues and different approaches, empathy. You know, it's funny because day one, like even in undergrad in mental health or psychology, a lot of times we're taught, how do we do a good summary where we're putting ourselves in our client's shoes? How do we be empathic? And what's interesting to me, and I pose this question to you to think about, you know, are we really an empathic people amidst our colleagues? You know, I've seen so many meetings at different organizations I've worked for where I'm like, wow, we're trying to be so empathic with clients, but are we really working towards that with our colleagues? Then when we're multiculturally competent, we also have a sense of perceptual acuity and open-mindedness. So how do we get to this place where we become increasingly more multiculturally competent? Well, Gerhard in 2019 uses an interesting phrase, and the phrase is developing a culturally competent quotient, CQ, culturally competent quotient. I find that phrase interesting. Gerhard talks about making sure we have mentors from different cultures. We're constantly self-evaluating our behavior, especially when we're around people who on any dimension of culture are different from us. That we have accountability to look at our biases and increase our knowledge base. We're watching programs from different cultures. We're traveling to areas where there might be differences. So not just our clinical time, but also our time personally, are we expanding our definitions of cultures? Are we really asking questions? And then are we being active listeners? He uses the idea of thought partners. What would it be like if you had someone, for example, in a school setting or even in a work setting where you were paired up with someone and you got to talk on different issues and learn how to deal with different opinions? They also talk in the literature about having diverse small groups, mentors, pen pals, even being actively immersed in the different cultures. Minimally, we need to be aware of the cultures that we tend to counsel and be with. And again, culture is so much more than initially what was thought in terms of ethnicity and race. There's multiple co-occurring dimensions. We want to increase our frequency of interaction with others. The literature on decreasing discrimination or prejudices overwhelmingly talks about as we increase the frequency of our interactions with others, we tend to have more positive interactions over time and realize that not everybody in any cultural group or any dimension is so bad. So even if we've had some awful experiences and we've made generalizations from those or stereotypes, if we would give ourselves time to broaden that base of interactions with people with different cultural views, we would tend to realize that some of these stereotypes fall away. The other thing we can look at is general terms and values that positive psychology might highlight. Things like altruism and kindness, gratitude, trust. How do we build that? Just building that with people in general can also help us be more multiculturally competent, can also help us be more effective. And finally, learning to be a cheerleader or an advocate for someone who's not like us. So in summary, we want to be genuinely interested in learning about what is important to the other. We want to learn to treat others with respect and dignity. And we want to affirm an effort, appreciate the efforts of others who are collaborating and trying to do problem solving with multiculturally competency. So when we look at the literature in terms of strategic problem solving, it's all about how we frame situations. There's a number of steps we can do in terms of the strategic problem solving. First of all, we really need to start by looking at framing the situation. So defining the what. What is going on according to how we see the problem? Oftentimes I find when two people or a group of people are interacting, part of the problem is that they simply have not framed the situation in the same way. And just recognizing and acknowledging that can make a huge difference. Second, we need to diagnose the problem. What are the thoughts and opinions amongst the group as to why this problem is going on? Again, we're not looking to all come to agreement and say that, yeah, this one thing is the solution. This is definitely why. But to consider an array of suggestions as to why. Then we want to find solutions. So we're looking at the how. Usually there's an array. There's multiple solutions. And then finally doing. How do we implement these solutions while we're recognizing these different points of view? A problem essentially can be defined as a difference between a goal state and an achievement state. So how do we go from this dissonance of this is where I'm at now compared to this is where I'd like to be? Let's brainstorm what contributed possibly to this and how do we get to the next point. One way of doing this is involving more perspectives. The more people with more cultural views we involve, the more people with different experiences we involve, the more possibilities, the divergence that happens. So what we do is we use what the literature calls brain writing strategies. So essentially, if you're in a group and you have like a whiteboard, like a marker board, you're just brainstorming. And again, we're not initially looking at the appropriateness or inappropriateness of any possible strategy. We're just looking at, wow, I had not considered this a strategy because my narrative and worldview is different from that other person. And essentially, the process of problem solving in a multiculturally competent manner is looking at what is the bottom line of the simplest things that we can all agree on. I look at when we're focusing on this concept of everyone matters and becoming multiculturally competent, we're essentially learning to empathize with all of our common humanity. How can we do that? Maybe we haven't had the same experience that this other client has, but yet there's feelings that sometimes their narrative can tap into. For example, I remember in graduate school, one of my professors asking our class, is it only women who could counsel women who were brutally raped? Is it possible that someone else could counsel that person? What about, could we listen to a client whose loved one died suddenly in a drive-by shooting? Maybe we're not from that community. Maybe we've not been in the middle of gun violence, but we're counseling a traumatized person. What about, could we empathize with a wealthy business person who owned a successful company who just lost their investments? I remember, for example, one of my most interesting and challenging types of clients that I had in the past was a couple who each had their own companies and were very, very successful at that. They were both middle-aged. And they were trying to make some decisions about, what do we do? We've done everything we wanted to in life. We've built up these companies and even founded other companies. We've helped other people. We've traveled around the world. And they basically were like, now what? They were coming to a point where they're like, people are saying we're supposed to retire. People are saying we're supposed to give our companies to someone else or pass a legacy on. But what ended up happening, first of all, the reason it was a challenge for me was because at that time, I was a young master's level, newly licensed LPCC. I certainly was not a wealthy LPCC. I certainly did not have many businesses, and I certainly had not traveled the world. But as I heard this couple's narratives, I heard one thread that seemed to keep coming was that people were telling them you should be doing A, B, and C, but yet they were saying, you know what? We're really happy where we're at. Who's to say we have to retire now? Who's to say we have to do this certain thing because we're this age? And so part of it was, okay, maybe my narrative, maybe what's helpful for me is to continue exactly what I'm already doing. What about things like empathizing with the common humanity of one of our clients, for example, who is a drug addict, who feels like he or she has no one left in their life because of their addiction? They have nowhere to go. Maybe they're on the streets. Can I identify with that? Especially if I've had a loving family that in spite of my stubbornness, sometimes was there for me. Can I listen to a person who has a prison record for attempted murder? Can I hear an employee's anger when they felt disrespected or not had the other opportunities in their mindset as another employee? How can I identify with a common humanity? How can I hear and relate to the client's narratives as the client expresses those? So one of the things to keep in mind is ethically, every possible discipline in the mental health field, whether it's psychology, counseling, mental health, marriage and family therapy, all have our ethical codes, which highlight the importance of being multiculturally competent. I'm going to read some of the phrases from those codes. They talk about the importance of understanding the complexities of diversity and multiculturalism and the counseling relationship. They talk about recognizing the negative influence of oppression on mental health and well-being. They talk about understanding individuals in the context of their social environment. And finally, they talk about integrating social justice advocacy into the psychotherapy and counseling we do. So our problem is, without trying to meet the client where he or she's at, we can end up doing what's called cultural encapsulation. Cultural encapsulation is basically basing our reactions on stereotypes, ignoring the cultural differences, avoiding critical subjects, and focusing on techniques to the point of excluding the individual narratives of client factors. The fact is that counseling is not culture free. It's not. There's a narrative each of our clients bring to us, and we need to try and find that out. We need to also not be afraid to broach topics. The number one thing the literature repeatedly says that clients value on a multicultural dimension is when we're sincere. Whether we understand where they're coming from, whether we experientially have been through that, whether we don't understand it, or maybe personally don't have the same values. When we broach topics, they see us as sincere, they see us as approachable, they see us as an effective counselor who wants to be part of their world. So broaching topics can be done through written policies of our organization, through laws, through legalities, through studying the history of an issue, looking at the resources available, or what further resources might be needed. Broaching is continually inviting the client to speak from their point of view on multicultural issues. So there's five ways people either approach or don't approach issues with clients. The worst would be the first ones that I share. And then as I talk, we'll be moving more towards the best ways of broaching these issues. So the first style would be an avoidance style. This is basically looking at cultural topics as neutral, just lumping everybody in the same category, kind of fostering those stereotypes and generalities. Then we move to an isolating way of looking, or approaching topics in an overly simplistic manner. The third style is called continuing/congruent, where we start to invite client invitation to explore issues of race, gender, other multicultural issues, and look at both the overall factors and the individual factors. The fourth style is called integrated/congruent, where we're not just on a superficial level bringing up the multicultural topics, but we're integrating them into the practice of counseling. So again, we're taking techniques and really finding out what's best for that client. Finally, the top one would be infusing. Infusing means we're having a consistent commitment to actually bringing up multicultural counseling issues. We're incorporating them, and we're committed to social justice issues, even outside counseling sessions. Counselors are perceived as more credible by clients when they bring up issues of culture directly. Again, why even bring culture into it? It prevents misdiagnosis. I've known of a number of situations where people were wrongly considered one diagnosis or another because the clinician didn't hear the fullness of the client's narrative. It prevents a sense of mistrust by clients. Again, if we try to hear their dimensions of culture, then they'll see us as sincere. They'll be more open to working with us. It prevents premature termination. It builds a stronger therapeutic alliance. Remember, what we're doing is a partnership of clinically working towards the goals, the therapeutic goals, to address the presenting concerns. Why bring culture into it? The feeling that the clients have, that the therapist, that we're more emotionally present. And it allows for freedom that there will be times where we feel more connected and other times where we feel more disconnected with a client. So we want to learn how to broach topics ways we can become more multiculturally competent involve, again, real-world exposure to various aspects of culture, development of a critical consciousness surrounding culture, movement from just knowing things factually to actually advocating regarding people of different cultural worldviews. There's a phrase that I really like in Barden and Cashwell's literature in 2016. The phrase they use is that a counselor is essentially a guest in the client's world. I love that phrase or that metaphor. See, we think of ourselves ultimately as, oh, we're the trained expert person that they're coming to for help. We're supposed to do something to make a difference. But actually, how would our therapy be different if we saw ourselves as coming into the client's world and then working through a therapeutic partnership? Sometimes part of cultural immersion might be interacting, again, with releases, with consent, with trying to understand the knowledge with community members. This may go beyond the counseling office. We also look at developmental connections that people might have. We're wanting to let go of the way that we would do things. The approach needs to be one of teach me. One interesting exercise that the literature cites is called a top 10 exercise. They suggest that you take critical areas of a client's life, or you could even do this in an education setting. Say you're able to be a professor or to teach counseling or psychotherapy. You could do this with your graduate students. Looking at what are the critical points that identify and define my identity. So something about who I am, something about my gifts or talents or hobbies, something about my beliefs and values or what I prioritize in life. What are some of the significant memories that have shaped me? What I've conquered or learned? My hopes and dreams and things that represent the core parts of me. Now, there's several different areas of culture in general that we could call basically the key determinants of culture. And these can give you a little more information about how a client views culture. First of all, does this client focus more on past, present, or future? Which is most important to him or her? Notice that, you know, if you think back on some of your clients, some may focus on, oh, I just need to get to this certain point in life. Their frustration, their presenting concerns are because they're not where they think they should be at that given point in time yet. So they're future oriented. Other clients struggle because they're stuck in looking back at how they wish they could be, and they're having difficulty moving beyond that. So that can give us some key information about how a client defines culture. Which is more important, past, present, or future? Another element that can be really important for us to look at is how a client views human nature. Do they see people, for example, as basically good, that we need to assume the best out of people? Or do they see that people are basically evil? If we're left to our own regard, we end up doing some crazy stuff. That can also tell you how they approach their worldview on things. Another element that we can look at is what are the client's views on family? For example, how do they define who their family is? Some people, family is their immediate biological family. Others, their community or their support systems who have been there for them are their family. Does family include family of origin? Or is it possible that there's people outside family of origin that may be closer or that someone can choose to have involved in their life that are more meaningful than family of origin. What does family mean? Is family a safe space? So when we're looking at family, are we talking about a nuclear family? Or are we talking about a community? Are we talking about a traditional family, like a mother, father, and kids? Are we talking about grandparents or someone else or a foster family or someone raising children? We're basically talking, when we talk about family, who eats together? Who does day-to-day life together? What's acceptable in terms of physical affection and vulnerability and sharing in this family setting? How are emotions expressed or concealed? What are the roles and responsibilities supposed to be? So those are important to look at in terms of the key determinants of culture. Another factor that's really important that'll tell you a lot about a client's cultural views is what their views are on emotions in general. To what extent should emotions be expressed or concealed? That'll tell you a lot. And again, I know our point of view as clinicians for years was that catharsis was good. I mean, initially when I went to grad school, that was what they taught. You know, just let loose, share whatever you feel. That's the way, let all the emotions out. But we know simply letting it out doesn't mean that it's going to heal the person. That sometimes it's almost like a pressure cooker where all that emotion's under, and when we let it out, if we haven't taught that client skills, oh boy, all sorts of stuff can come out. But there are different worldviews that clients have about what we do with emotions and how much they should or shouldn't be expressed. Another variation of all this about family and emotions is to look at whose needs take precedence. Is it about the individual? So is it about the person coming to counseling? About self-care and them being their best self? Or is it about the community and the peace of mind of the group or the larger good? Again, these are not goals, I know probably for most of you in our grad schools, these were not necessarily goals that we traditionally thought of. But if we're going to be competent in terms of being multiculturally competent, we need to think about these options. And even things like gender roles. Another thing that's important when we're looking at client's sense of his or her identity, we need to look at the client's ideas about how did I get here? Who am I? Who are my people? Where do I come from? What is my heritage? Is there any story behind that? Including who they would see as role models. Who is it that I looked up to? Who did I learn from? Who influenced me? Were there people that were significant parts of my story? Now, I do want to say the other side of this is that if we're doing something like narrative therapy with a client towards his or her therapy goals, it is possible if the client feels like certain people or groups negatively influenced him or her, that they can also change that narrative. We can use that therapeutically to look at who they want to allow in their story from here on out. Who they might want to change, what ways they would define those people, how much or how little they want to interact. Like I tell my clients, everything's modifiable. Just because something happened to this way, to this point, doesn't mean it can't be changed. It's also important to hear from a client who their heroes are. And what have they done, if you look at a solution-focused or a strengths-based approach, to overcome, to change, or to develop over time. So we're all familiar with the importance of being empathic, of understanding things from the client's point of view and communicating that to him or her effectively. But the literature would also highlight this phrase, cultural empathy. So this is another variation on empathy in general. Cultural empathy involves retaining one separate cultural identity. So I have my combination of aspects of culture that define who I am as a clinician, but simultaneously being aware of and accepting the cultural values and beliefs of the client. So validating the client's inner experience, acknowledging the client's subjective world. How do I do this? I describe what the client is experiencing in words that he or she can validate. I express interest in learning about the client's experience. I clarify language and meanings. I convey an honest desire to help the clients. I face rather than ignore or overlook the cultural differences. So remember the broaching we talked about a little bit ago. And I discuss cultural differences that the client might seem as pertinent. So part of that is understanding how the client's feeling, the situations as the client sees them, and what they would like to happen in the future. If you remember a little bit ago, I said sincerity was one of the big foundations that clients repeatedly in the literature highlighted, that they said was one of the biggest things that they liked about clinicians, that they felt heard. Sincerity means having good intention or realness. Clients felt that even if we didn't really know or understand experientially their narrative, with sincerity, they felt understood, that we were trying to learn, trying to hear what makes that client who they are. Other elements of effective cross-cultural counseling include things like service energy, meaning communicating to the client the value that they are, learning and willingness to learn more about the client's culture. So building our knowledge, building our experience and engagement with other aspects of culture, reading up on, studying and researching, allowing the client to essentially teach us. Other elements that are important is being non-judgmental. So again, avoid jumping to conclusions based on our own limited experiences or prejudices. Letting go of being authorities. Being resourceful. Be aware of what the community resources are. Being sensitive to what is or is not an issue for the client. Learning the background or the historical story behind the various aspects of culture that the client would consider important. And then having an ongoing sense of critical reflection. And a lot of that can really best be done if we have colleagues that we regularly check in with. Another important aspect to consider, as I talked briefly about earlier, was this concept of wellness versus disease. We're trained so much in the mental health field to emphasize this and put emphasis on the medical model. But this doesn't always necessarily fit well with the idea of multicultural competency. Remember, other cultures focus on things like spirituality and other areas rather than disease and medicine. So we need to have that resourcefulness, talk to the community, read about and learn more about the cultural bound syndromes. That especially was brought home to me when I did some studies on grief. There's some very interesting rituals, if you read the literature out there, about practices that people around the world have in terms of trying to do meaning-making or making sense of grief experiences. Some people believed that the negative people, spirits, ancestors of the dead person might try to kill them too. There were some cultures around the world who set out basically a picnic array of all kind of foods so that they wouldn't be the next person to die. There were rituals that many cultures did to avoid death. Some people approach death. So, for example, when we're looking at cultural bound syndromes, there's ideas about how mental health issues should or should not be approached. And we really want to hear what the client's beliefs are about that. Even the idea about, is mental health an issue? What are, quote, those mental health people like? Some people have been taught, based on their combination of cultural points of view, that traditional counseling, whether in a private office or going to a doctor, is just not okay. Some of them instead believe in their native healers, their shamans, gurus, or exorcists. Some people frown upon the medical field or professionals in general. Others really place emphasis on things like extended family or community. Some place emphasis on arranged marriages. Some place emphasis on their family's input and opinions. It's really important to look at this. What are the concepts of this specific client coming to me about wellness and disease? And also, what is distressing to this client? Do they see emotional pain as distressing? Physical somatic symptoms? Bad luck or curses from others who might be watching or tracking them? Or their regional fables or narratives? When I talk about so many layers of culture co-occurring, one of the things I like to highlight is this acronym, RESPECTFUL. I know I tend to share this in the cultural seminars I teach, but I like because it hits on a number of the different dimensions that might be important to a client. So R being the religious or spiritual dimension. And with these dimensions, it could be whether they're important or even if they're not important. If you have an atheist, that's still important to know when you're working with that person on the religious or spiritual. If you have a person who prides themselves on doing some kind of spiritual practice every day, that's also important to know. So R is religious or spiritual. E is economic class. So not just where they're at, but maybe where they'd like to be. Or what their views have been taught about that, if this is something the client's saying is a pertinent issue to him or her. S, sexual identity. How does he or she identify themselves? Male, female, or something else? What would they like to be? Is that something that their family, their friends, their support systems, the people around them support, agree with? Is it a challenging point? What about their psychological development? So P, psychological development. Either ethnic or racial identity. C, chronological, in other words, developmental issues. T, trauma or threats to well-being. F, family issues. U, unique physical issues. And L, language. One of the things that I want to make sure that we talk about here a little bit, again, is highlighting that the traditional goals in terms of goal formation for treatment planning and goals are rather Euro-American goals. Things like building self-esteem, self-care, developing assertiveness, being more independent or individualistic. Keep in mind that many people in the world do not necessarily espouse these views. So the Western views focus on individuality, emphasize youth, independence, nonconformity, and competition. Whereas more Eastern goals or alternative goals might focus on relationship, extended family focus, maturity, interdependence, conformity or cooperation. Traditional Western goals talk about the responsibility is within the individual. You hear a lot about strong will, make your mind up, learn these things, just do something different. Change is considered very good in the traditional Western European goals. But there's also some good things about the idea, which would be considered a more Eastern worldview, that support is good. The importance of the collective goals, looking at things like nature, harmony, security, responsibility in the society, collective actualization as opposed to self-actualization, and relational morals. So we need to look at alternative multicultural goals, like promoting collective well-being, developing relationships with those in the group, avoiding conflict or maintaining peace, building a multi-generational identity, stimulating someone's personal narrative, deference to authority, respect for elders, things like equilibrium with nature, unity with others, and fulfillment of family obligations. So towards the Eastern goals, we might use more mindfulness, things like helping clients to observe their thoughts, feelings, and sensations, helping them act with awareness, helping them learn to describe their inner experiences, and remaining non-judging of others, remaining non-reactive. So one of the things that I would encourage you to do is to watch the video summarizing multicultural counseling. It kind of hits on some of what we've talked about to this point, but also a few other additional things. And then when we come back for the second part, we're going to talk about social justice more, that being a key issue, as we hear with the issues lately in the news and media. So to summarize, again, when we're talking about cultural competency and everyone mattering, we're talking about several elements of the way a client does something, the way he or she perceives things, the narratives at work, and all these elements are kind of converging together. But the key is, instead of ourselves as the clinicians making determinations about which aspects are important, we're basically coming at the client of, help me, tell me, teach me, let me learn, doing the cultural empathy thing. And then we want to make sure we're broaching topics head on. We also talked about not just with our relationships clinically with clients, but even in work settings, even in agency settings, how having more of a multicultural competency approach can be beneficial to problem solving, because it helps us to think more divergently. It helps us to come up with various ideas and to brainstorm better. So definitely watch the video from here on multicultural counseling and the overview, and then we'll come back soon and talk more about social justice.